KRWG News This Week, I'm Fred Martino. We begin this series with a very special program, a full hour on Election 2020. And we start with New Mexico's 2nd District Congressional race, one of the most hotly contested in the nation. It's the second battle between incumbent Democratic Congresswoman Xochitl Torres-Small and former state legislator Yvette Herrill. Torres-Small beat Herrill in 2018 by less than 2%, just a few thousand votes. And this year, a recent poll sponsored by the Albuquerque Journal found the race too close to call. A recent KOAT-TV debate may provide some answers as to why the race seems to be a repeat of 2018. Torres-Small focuses largely on one message, bipartisanship. During the debate, the candidates were allowed to ask each other one question, and Herrill seemed to try to court voters who support President Donald Trump. She noted that Torres-Small's ads mention a willingness to work with Trump. Then Herrill noted that Torres-Small voted to impeach Trump. But Torres-Small said you can be bipartisan and still hold people accountable.
Part of working together is being willing to show respect enough to hold people accountable. It doesn't mean being a pushover. It means standing up for New Mexicans. And that's what I did when I felt like our national security was at risk, when there was a potential that that the president was using his office for political gain and misusing military support to do so.
Herrill also asked Torres-Small if she planned to vote for Vice President Joe Biden. Initially, Torres-Small failed to answer. But later, in a question about energy policy, she said she would support Biden, but did not agree with his approach to energy.
I would vote for Vice President Biden, but I do not agree with his oil and gas approach. I stood up to my party to say that we should not ban fracking.
To be clear, Vice President Biden has not called for a ban on fracking. His campaign has said there should be no new licenses for fracking on federal lands. When it came time for Torres-Small to ask Herrill a question, she referenced Herrill's voting record as a state legislator, noting that Herrill voted against a bill that would have prevented state lawmakers from becoming a lobbyist for 2 years after they leave office. Herrill said the bill was flawed, but did not explain how it was flawed.
Yeah, great question. And I voted against that bill because we didn't have all of the information put together. I worked with parties across the aisle, both Democrats and Republicans, so that we could ensure that when we did pass a bill in New Mexico that would be effective and address the issue at hand in terms of lobbying, we absolutely would do so. But that bill was not ready.
The issue of public officials becoming lobbyists is a big one in New Mexico, and not just for elected officials. Ryan Flynn served as Environment Secretary under Republican Governor Susana Martinez. Then he went to work as Executive Director of the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association, a job he still holds, advocating for an industry he was previously hired to regulate. Speaking of regulations, we move to one area where the two candidates differ. A moderator asked if the candidates could support gun safety measures like a ban on military-style semi-automatic weapons. Herrill not only said she would be against a ban, she would not support any legislation, a position she also held in the primary.
I do not support any ban. In fact, I would not support any legislation that would have an impact on our Second Amendment. I think we need to be standing strong to protect our Second Amendment.
Torres-Small said gun safety measures and the Second Amendment can coexist.
I grew up in a household that owned guns, and I'm a hunter. And one of the earliest serious conversations I remember having with my grandfather was about that checklist that you run through every time you use a gun as a tool to make sure that you're keeping yourself and others safe. And I believe the same thing when it comes to legislation, that we have to look at it carefully and that there shouldn't be loopholes when it comes to our legislation either. There's no shortcuts. That's why I did support comprehensive background checks, a legislation that 87% of New Mexicans support and the majority of gun owners, because we know that you can both protect your Second Amendment rights and protect communities at the same time.
Torres Small has been careful to show her support of gun rights, even using weapons in television ads in 2018 and this year. New Mexico's 2nd District Congressional race, certainly one to watch. And there's another interesting race in New Mexico as well for every voter in the state, our U.S. Senate race. And the candidates' positions on health care policy may tell you a lot about how they view the role of government. Republican Mark Ronchetti's line of attack against Congressman Ben Ray Lujan has been repeated in races nationwide for years. In attacking Lujan's support of a single-payer health care system, Ronchetti says it would be too expensive and wouldn't solve the problem.
Well, when has a government program ever saved people money in this particular case? So, Congressman, what you advocate for, unfortunately, is a takeover of the health care system.
In the same answer, Ronchetti pledged support for Medicare and Medicaid, big parts of the U.S. healthcare system tied to federal and state government. Lost in the debate, the numbers. The Commonwealth Fund notes the U.S. spends more on healthcare as a share of the economy, nearly twice as much as the average OECD country, yet has the lowest life expectancy and the highest suicide rates among the 11 nations. And compared to peer nations, the U.S. has among the highest number of hospitalizations from preventable causes and the highest rate of avoidable deaths. But Ronchetti says government care is not the answer, even saying there's a way to reduce costs in our private, for-profit system.
We can drive down prescription drug costs. We can get people better access to the care they need for cheaper. But it's not going to be because the government swallows it up. It's going to be because the people have choice.
In fact, government-run healthcare systems can dramatically reduce costs due to low administrative expenses, no profits, and enormous buying power that allows for lower negotiated prices. Let's use Ronchetti's example of prescription drugs. A study in the Journal of the American Medical Association estimated a 38 to 50% savings on drugs if Medicare's prescription drug benefit used prices provided to the Veterans Administration. The VA negotiates prices, while Medicare Part D and its large number of different private insurers do not. Even if those insurers could negotiate prices, the large number of companies would not allow for the buying power of the VA, and just as in other private insurance, administrative costs tend to be higher due to profits, marketing, and other expenses. Libertarian candidate Bob Walsh also spoke out against government-provided health care, specifically describing it as part of his party's political philosophy.
Libertarians believe that we should have a free market in healthcare, that everyone should be able to choose the level of insurance they want, the doctors they want, and the treatments they want.
While the approach Walsh described could theoretically reduce cost, it wouldn't work in our current system. People without the funds for healthcare couldn't access the free market. And people who were underinsured in the free market might get care anyway, raising costs for those with better plans. In fact, a report by the American Hospital Association shows hospitals provided more than $660 billion in uncompensated care over the last two decades alone. And the for-profit system costs individuals, too. Even with the expansion of government support under the Affordable Care Act, one study found some 530,000 American families file for bankruptcy each year due to medical expenses. The American Public Journal of Health also cites job losses in its study, a reminder that buying health insurance and tying it to a job is also part of the reason medical bills are still the number one source of bankruptcy filings in the country, a problem that is expected to get worse with long-term job losses caused by the pandemic. But bankruptcy also happens to those who are insured due to copays and deductibles, and that problem could increase because the Trump administration now allows insurance companies to sell cheaper policies for up to 3 years that do not provide coverage mandated under the Affordable Care Act. Congressman Ben Ray Lujan says eliminating costs for individuals is one reason he's supported a single-payer plan.
For people, it would mean no deductibles and no premiums. And look, let's just face this. The United States right now is investing more in healthcare than any other industrialized nation, but people aren't getting the support that they need. And that's why I'm open to ideas that will drive down the cost of care. It's why I've been such a proud supporter of the Affordable Care Act.
And now, even the Affordable Care Act is at risk. Right after the election, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear a challenge to its constitutionality. You've heard New Mexico's U.S. Senate candidates talk about health care, but what about President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden? Dr. James Lenhart is a family medicine specialist in Tacoma, Washington. With over four decades in medicine, he's seen it all. And in 2017, he talked with KRWG News about his book, Conversations for Paco, Why America Needs Healthcare for All. While the story was fictional, the situations in the book caused by America's lack of universal care are very real for millions. And Lenhart says politics is to blame, with politicians and others demonizing government-funded health insurance as socialism.
Socialized medicine works, and it works much better. We just don't like that term, socialized.
Yeah.
But all of those countries have, quote unquote, socialized medicine, health care for all, and they have far better outcomes than the United States, which decries that whole notion of socialized medicine.
While universal care costs less per capita with much better outcomes, U.S. voters see the same playbook painting any move toward government-funded care as corrupt. When the repeal of the Affordable Care Act failed in the Senate, President Trump blamed corruption and vowed to continue efforts to destroy the law.
The swamp. But we'll get it done. We're going to get it done. You know, I said from the beginning, let Obamacare implode and then do it. I turned out to be right. Let Obamacare implode.
A decade later, the law stands, even after the Republican tax bill that removed one of the Affordable Care Act's main provisions, the penalty for failing to have coverage. But a lawsuit backed by the Trump administration leaves the constitutionality of the ACA in the hands of the Supreme Court. Some 20 million more Americans have health insurance thanks to the law. When it passed in 2010, nearly one in four were uninsured. By 2016, that changed dramatically. A little more than 12% were uninsured, just 2 years after insurance marketplaces opened and some states provided Medicaid to more low-income residents. If elected, Joe Biden wants Congress to expand Medicaid in the 14 states, including Texas, that failed to do so. Texas has the highest rate of uninsured residents in the country, nearly one in five adults, as reported by the U.S. Census Bureau. Biden also wants to help low-income people who don't have Medicaid but struggle to pay for insurance, limiting the percentage of income they have to spend.
We're going to lower premiums for people buying coverage on their own by guaranteeing that no American ever has to spend more than 8.5% of their income on health insurance. And that number will be lower for lower-income people.
President Trump has also said he wants to reduce the cost of insurance, but has not revealed the details for accomplishing that. The Washington Post assembled a video in which Trump promised a plan on camera at least 15 times, dating back to the beginning of his administration.
As soon as our secretary is approved and gets into the office, we'll be filing a plan.
We have a really terrific, I believe, health care plan coming out.
We're going to have a health care plan that's going to be second to none. It's going to be great.
While Trump has not released a detailed plan, his continued efforts in court to nullify the Affordable Care Act indicate a move away from government regulation over health care. Meantime, Biden wants to provide a public option, something in the original plan for the Affordable Care Act that was removed after opposition from the industry and many Republicans.
We need a public option now more than ever, especially when more than 20 million people are unemployed. That public option will allow every American, regardless of their employment status, the choice to get a Medicare-like plan. It will force private insurers to keep premiums low, offer better coverage, because for the first time, they'll have to compete for your business against a public insurer that doesn't have to make a profit.
It's unclear if such a plan would be approved by Congress, especially if Republicans maintain control of the U.S. Senate. But if approved, it could move the U.S. closer to universal coverage. And Dr. James Lenhart says using health care premiums for health care, not profits, should always be the focus.
Profit doesn't have any place in health care, because you can't. If you're worried about your bottom line all the time and you're so concerned that you're going to have your stockholders have return on their investment, you can't deliver the best of care.
From the critical issue of health care, we move to what may be the most important issue in this election, voter turnout. And efforts are underway in New Mexico and across the nation to get more young people to the polls. In depth, here's KRWG public media intern Xavier Dominguez.
A Pew Research study projects Generation Z and millennials will make up 37% of the vote nationwide.
So young people make up the largest and most diverse group of potential voters in the history of the country.
Mia Tonsudonati is in her first semester interning for NMPIRG as a social media coordinator and is involved with the New Voters Project. The project is targeting younger generations to help them get registered to vote, especially college students here in New Mexico.
And so we try to reach out through them to them through phone banking, emailing, calling, social media, because right now that's really the only way to do it. And so college students, I think, have been our biggest focus because they can vote and they should vote.
The U.S. Census Bureau reports 18 to 29-year-old voter turnout went from 19.9% in 2014 to 35.6% in 2018. That's the largest percentage increase for any age group. Before the elections take place, both the New Mexico Democratic and Republican parties are using new strategies to reach out to young voters.
DPN has been finding new ways to connect with Democrats.
Republican Party Chair Steve Pierce says safety and economic issues are of great concern.
The Republican Party of New Mexico, just the thing that we're noticing right now, people are alarmed about their safety and they're also alarmed about their economic security. As you deal with the kids in college, then you're talking about the jobs again.
In a statement, the Democratic Party of New Mexico says it is working to create a New Mexico where everyone has access to quality, affordable health care, students are able to get a great education, and jobs paying a living wage. From Nikita Otake, New Mexico for All Organizing Director. About a half of a million New Mexicos, more than 2 million residents, are 18 to 39. A 2019 Pew Research study found that 90% of 18 to 29-year-olds use at least one social media site to communicate on a daily basis. And Republican Chair Steve Pierce says that that means the party must adapt.
We use young people heavily in those management teams and in the teams that are making decisions. And that word gets around. The communication is a different style than it might be if I were doing the total communication.
The Democratic Party of New Mexico says it's using the online video platform Zoom and other forms of social media to reach young voters.
We hear from voters in every corner.
NMPIRG is a nonpartisan organization that has been reaching out to youth voters on college campuses for more than 25 years, and Mia Tontanati sees a rise in student involvement.
I think generally students have been very excited to vote, as far as I've seen. I think that this is a really big election for everybody, and everyone has things that matter to them in this election. So everyone, especially young people, I think are really excited to get out and vote this November.
Pierce says he's seeing more young people who identify with the Republican positions.
A lot of young people are saying, wait, we watched the internet and we're kind of believing it, but now we find we're actually very conservative. We like the traditional values. We like the family. We like the organization of the free market and our opportunities.
Democrats are counting on an increase in voter turnout among young people and minorities. Pew Research reports a third of eligible voters will be non-white in 2020, up from about a quarter in 2000. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Xavier Dominguez.
And Xavier will be back two more times in this program talking with young Democrats and Republicans about the issues most important to them. Well, it may not be on their radar right now, but Social Security is important to each and every American. And while Vice President Joe Biden has a plan to strengthen the program, President Trump has not released such a plan and has also proposed cuts. President Trump has repeatedly said he would not cut Social Security, but when asked if he would cut entitlements in a Fox town hall, he said he would.
But if you don't cut something in entitlements, you'll never really deal with the debt.
Oh, we'll be cutting, but we're also going to have growth like you've never had before.
And Trump kept his promise to make cuts, according to FactCheck.org, which noted in Trump's proposed federal spending plan on Social Security, the budget calls for changes to disability benefits that would translate to cuts for some beneficiaries. On Medicaid, there are more significant but not well-defined cuts. FactCheck also says the Trump budget includes reductions in future projected Medicare spending. The Fox Town Hall was not the only time when Trump addressed making changes to entitlements. He also promised changes in a CNBC interview.
Entitlements ever be on your plate?
At some point they will be. We have tremendous growth. We're going to have tremendous growth this next year. It'll be toward the end of the year. The growth is going to be incredible. And at the right time, we will take a look at that. You know, that's actually the easiest of all things, if you look.
It's not clear what Trump meant when he said changing entitlements was the easiest of all things. But he did sign an executive order allowing deferral of payroll taxes that fund entitlements. And he said if he's reelected, he would ensure workers don't have to pay back deferred taxes. But it's not clear how that would work, since funding the deficit cannot be accomplished with an executive order. It's also not clear how Trump would shore up the Social Security system, since he has not released a plan to do so. Joe Biden's plan would impose the 6.2% Social Security tax on earnings above $400,000. Right now, employees and their employers are only taxed on earnings up to $137,000, an amount that increases each year. An analysis by the Urban Institute says Biden's plan for Social Security and supplemental security income would lift 1.4 million Americans out of poverty in its first year. Biden talked about the plans in a Vice News town hall.
My proposal on Social Security has been straightforward from the beginning. We have to increase the taxes on people making over $400,000 so they pay the exact same percentage of their income as we pay for if you're making $50,000 or $20,000 or $128,000. That will make sure it's solvent for all the young people in this audience and also allow us to raise the amount of money for those people who are living way beyond what the Social Security expected them to live, so they, in fact, can have an increase in their Social Security payment, as well as if they lose a spouse and their Social Security is reduced.
And making long-delayed changes to shore up Social Security is essential to maintain current benefits. The Social Security Administration says by 2035, the number of Americans 65 and older will increase from about 56 million today to over 78 million. And while there will be more people drawing benefits, the ratio of workers to beneficiaries will go down. There are currently 2.8 workers for each Social Security beneficiary. By 2035, there will be 2.3 covered workers for each beneficiary. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for joining us for the premiere of KRWG News this week in our special full hour on Election 2020. The structure of a commission charged primarily with regulating public utilities in New Mexico is on the ballot as voters weigh Constitutional Amendment 1. If approved, the measure would see the Public Regulation Commission turn from an elected body to one made up of appointed commissioners. KUNM's Nash Jones reports.
The PRC regulates the companies that provide the public with utility services. All of the companies are monopolies, in part because they require so much infrastructure. PRC Commissioner Cynthia Hall describes the group's work this way.
If you think of your bills that you get at the end of the month, the rates they charge are regulated by us. We stand in the place of competition. The monopolies can't raise their prices without our permission. We're like a mini court system.
Since its inception in 1996, the commission has been made up of five members, each elected to represent a district of the state for a four-year term. New Mexico is one of only 12 states that elects its Utility Regulation Commission. The constitutional amendment would change that, doing away with the districts and having the governor appoint three commissioners from a list of nominees made by a bipartisan legislative committee. They would then need to be confirmed by the state Senate before serving a six-year term. One of the arguments over the amendment is about whether commissioners should be subject matter experts with statewide interests in mind or advocates for their own districts.
People that live out in rural New Mexico, the farmers, the sheep herders, they should have that right to choose their own representative.
PRC Commissioner Teresa Bicente Aguilar, a Democrat who represents the rural Northwest District of the state, opposes the amendment. She says her life experience and relationships make her better able to advocate for the utility needs of her constituents. She's Diné and grew up on the Navajo Nation.
In a one-room hogan, no electricity, no telephone, no running water. As a child, I saw the shortcomings. It was a battle. I said I wanted to reach the office that's going to answer to my people.
Democratic Commissioner Cynthia Hall, who's running for re-election to represent the district that comprises most of Albuquerque, is the only commissioner who's publicly supporting the amendment right now. She favors appointed commissioners with no districts.
I consider everybody in the state as my constituents. Our duty is to everybody in the state because the utilities that we regulate operate across the state.
Hall argues that expertise in things like the law, economics, and engineering is more important than regional affiliation. She's concerned that the commission has been used as a political stepping stone.
The job became a magnet for people who were good at getting elected. You had people making decisions who really didn't know what they were doing.
Back in 2012, voters approved a measure to increase the minimum qualifications for commissioners and add a continuing education requirement. But Republican Senator Bill Payne, who co-sponsored last year's bill to put this amendment on the ballot, says those previous changes were insufficient.
The qualifications aren't particularly meaningful, and the continuing education is whatever the commissioners decided is. So it can be a lot or it can be nothing.
He says the nominating and appointing process would make for a more competent panel. Commissioner Hall says the election process also deters some qualified individuals from serving.
I have talked to numerous people to try to encourage them to run, and they just don't want to run for public office. So we're not tapping an important pool of talent and knowledge in our state.
Commissioner Vicente Aguilar, who opposes the amendment, argues that the PRC does not lack expertise.
We have talented, professional, expert staff on board. And when we make the final decision, we always have our constituents in mind. That's the important point when it comes to appointed versus elected.
Nonpartisan public policy advocacy organization Think New Mexico published a 2011 report on the PRC. The executive director said in an email that while appointed commissions, quote, tend to be somewhat more qualified, elected commissions, quote, tend to be more responsive to consumers' needs and keep rates a bit lower, unquote. As New Mexico embarks on a 25-year transition to renewable energy and ratepayers face new economic hardships, PRC commissioners, whether elected or appointed, will play an important role in meeting the utility needs of the state. For KUNM, I'm Nash Jones.
Continuing our discussions with young voters now, KRWG public media intern Xavier Dominguez talked with members of the NMSU College Democrats.
A Pew Research study says Gen Z and millennials are projected to make up 37% of the vote nationwide.
As youth, what we need to especially do now more than ever is have our voice be heard. Because I think because our demographic usually does not tend to show up to the polls as much, I feel like our voice is needed more than ever so we can advocate.
Isaiah Torres, the treasurer of NMSU College Democrats, is pushing for change. And he says education needs better support from our government.
I'm a very big advocate in education, and I feel like our educators, like our professors, our teachers, need to get paid more because they are educating our future doctors, our future lawyers, our future anything.
With New Mexico ranking 50th in the nation in education, in 2019, according to edweek.org, Torres says there should be an easier path financially when going to college.
Student debt is a really big factor for people because you tend to base your decision on, do I want to spend this money on a piece of paper? But that piece of paper is going to change your life, and some people are not given that opportunity.
Savannah Quintana Eddins, the secretary of NMSU College Democrats, expands on why education is an important issue to her as well.
I've always cared about education just because I come from a family of educators. Well, I'd say like the current federal administration has not handled the education system very well. It's never a good idea to privatize something like public education.
As a border region, Southern New Mexico voters like Quintana Eddins are also focused on immigration. In 2018, nearly 200,000 immigrants comprised about 9% of New Mexico's population, according to the American Immigration Council.
I really do believe that, specifically looking at the border. You know, We are a nation of immigrants, and that's who we need to be welcoming, and we need to find a way to have a secure border, but also welcome people into our country.
For many, including Isaiah Torres, immigration is personal.
Well, the one thing about me is that being Hispanic, it is it's very concerning to me because I have a lot of friends who are natives from Mexico.
And Torres says immigrants must be given more than permission to stay in the United States. He says they should have a better path to citizenship.
I think that would be the first thing to deal with immigrants is dealing with the immigrants here in the United States. Then we could resolve to would be a better way to find a path to citizenship for people who want to come into the United States.
The pandemic is also a major issue for young people and voters of all ages. Back in 2016, the National Security Council under the Obama administration developed a 69-page guidebook on how to respond to a pandemic. Eden shares her thoughts on how the Trump administration has handled COVID-19.
I think it's incredibly sad the way that the administration has handled it. There would be so many less people dead and infected right now if they had said from the beginning, if the president had gotten the information from the intelligence community and used that information to kickstart a response.
Eddins gives some advice to the next administration when handling the pandemic.
We have to tackle the public health crisis before we can move on to helping our economy. So I think initially that's what I hope for, is that for whoever is a new administration starting off in January, we'll look at the pandemic and really hit it hard so that we can help the people, get everyone healthy and safe, figure out a new way to live, because we're not just going to go back to normal. We need to have new ways to live.
Healthcare in general and climate change were other major issues for the young Democrats we spoke with. Isaiah Torres says those are part of a platform focused on social justice.
And the one thing I do prioritize, because this really hits home with me, is the social injustice in America. I feel like there needs to be police reform. I feel like there needs to be a better way to dealing with immigration. I feel like there just needs to be a better way to dealing with healthcare. And it's going to take a lot of work, but I feel like the next administration, hopefully the next administration, can really deal with all these things. And most importantly, that we could come together as a nation, because at the end of the day, we may have these labels as Democrats and Republicans, but we're Americans. We want the best for America. And hopefully we could come together and figure some stuff out.
Keithana Eddins says she's inspired by the prospect for change, led in part for young elected officials.
I also think that, you know, the younger generation of people who are running for office right now is very inspiring. Looking at issues that young people are interested in, like healthcare and climate change, things like that. But I think that we have a very positive future.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Xavier Dominguez.
And Xavier will be back one more time in the program to speak with college Republicans at New Mexico State University. Newly naturalized citizens could sway the outcome of this year's presidential, senatorial, and gubernatorial elections, according to a new report by the National Partnership for New Americans. It says 3 million have become citizens since Donald Trump's election. New Mexico ranks 15th as the state in which new citizens can have the greatest influence in this year's election. But New Mexico residents wanting to become citizens face many hurdles, including language and cost barriers. KUNM's Yasmin Khan reports.
I met Juana Santos in the backyard of her home near downtown Albuquerque. She was busy hanging laundry, cooking lunch, and tending to her two grandsons with their online classes. Since moving here from Peru in 2014, she has gotten involved with local immigrant organizations where she hands out food. She says families have been working hard, paying taxes, but are still going hungry during the pandemic. She attributes that to the lack of government support for undocumented workers.
Estamos afectados con nuestro gobierno actual.
We are impacted by our current government. One, because of so many deportations, and because Trump said he will take away health insurance from I don't know how many million people. Immigrants are suffering because they don't receive benefits, but they still pay a lot of taxes. Santos says she fears what might happen if Trump stays in office. How good it would be to see a change of administration away from the current president. But if that doesn't happen, what if we still have him as our president? What would we do? May God bless this country. Santos says she really wants to be able to vote, but can't pass the citizenship test because she doesn't speak English. The government allows people 55 and older to take the test in their native language after they've been permanent residents for at least 15 years. For 77-year-old Santos, that means waiting almost another decade. I think it's unfair for older people. I mean, who knows when we will pass from this world to the other? Maria Teresa Herrera Bustamante is an educator with Catholic Charities in Albuquerque, helping Spanish speakers get ready to take the citizenship test. She says it has written and oral sections, and you have to learn 100 civics questions for the multiple choice.
everywhere from, you know, who's the president of the United States, all the way to when was the Constitution written.
And the test is difficult, even for English speakers. According to a 2019 study by a national foundation, only 4 in 10 citizens could pass a sample test. Diego Iniguez Lopez is a policy and campaign manager with the National Partnership for New Americans, or NPNA. At a press conference Tuesday, he said record numbers of immigrants have applied for citizenship since 2014, and it's become a lot more difficult.
Over the last several years, the Trump administration has tried to make that process of citizenship more expensive, more complicated, and more lengthy.
The NPNA reports the Trump administration has nearly doubled the cost of filing, from $640 to $1,160, and slowed down processing.
What we've described as a second wall.
Between these hurdles and what the NPNA calls political unwillingness of U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services to address a massive backlog of applications, there are nearly 1,000 people in New Mexico who should be eligible to vote in 2020 but can't. Language barriers to getting a ballot also suppress voting by non-English speakers. Still, Iniguez Lopez says newly naturalized citizens can be a deciding factor in local and national elections. Since 2014, the NPNA reports there are 18,000 new citizens in New Mexico, many of them young women.
And they can have a tremendous impact on what this country looks like in 2021. But in order to display that impact, newly naturalized citizens have to vote.
Elisa Perez came from Chihuahua, Mexico to New Mexico in 1998. She says she first took the citizenship test in 2010 and didn't pass because of the language barrier. She finally passed the exam in March of this year and is excited to cast her ballot in the U.S. for the first time. We need just representatives who offer us opportunities and needed services. Above all, as immigrants, we have helped this country so much. I will vote for the first time in November, for me, for my family, and for my community, because my vote will be my voice.
Mi voto va a ser mi voz.
For KUNM, I'm Yasmin Khan.
Well, there are others who are dreaming of becoming a U.S. citizen, many asylum seekers. They're stuck, though, in Mexico under the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, and they are closely following the election across the border. They hope if Joe Biden is elected as president, he will end MPP. One of many efforts by the Trump administration to restrict legal and illegal immigration. KERA's Mallory Falk has more.
Nico Palazzo is an attorney with Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center and represents clients in MPP. He says a new administration could stop placing people in the program. But what about everyone who's already in MPP, waiting in Mexico?
I don't expect, you know, the last week of January for the gates to be open and people just allowed to shuffle in. We're talking thousands of people.
By now, you know the story. Those people, they came to the U.S. seeking asylum. Immigration officials gave them a court date, then sent them across the border to wait in Mexico. But here's a slightly different story. During that wait, two of them fell in love.
Nosotros venimos acá sin ningún pensamiento de que me voy a casar.
Jose is a nurse who fled political persecution in Nicaragua. We're not using his full name since his asylum case is still under review. After he was put in MPP, he found his way to a migrant shelter. It's the last place he expected to find love. But he noticed a woman there and struck up a conversation. He learned she was from Guatemala, also here seeking asylum. At first, Jose got her number, but not her name.
I just put guate in the phone.
They talked constantly. He brought her chocolate.
I never thought I'd meet someone who I just connected with like that. People say, oh, that's just a passing thing. But it's not. When you find the ideal person, someone who gives you the support you were lacking, the embrace you didn't have.
They moved in together, sharing a room at the shelter. Their asylum cases are in different stages, and their future together is uncertain. Still, he asked her to marry him. She said yes. They're expecting a baby next month. And like so many others, they're waiting to see what the presidential election brings.
Cambiando presidente cambia la política. Está claro.
Changing the president obviously changes policies.
Attorney Nico Palazzo says asylum seekers and MPP, like Jose and his fiance, should be paroled into the U.S. to wait out their legal proceedings.
Can you imagine being a migrant living in Mexico, not knowing anyone, having very little resources, and being able to effectively prepare and do all of the hard work that is involved in defending yourself in immigration proceedings and requesting asylum?
Plus, it can be dangerous. People in MPP are often targeted by criminals. Palazzo says in the U.S., it's also easier to get a lawyer. Just 7% of asylum seekers in MPP have had legal representation, according to an analysis from the Track Immigration Project at Syracuse University. And they'd make their cases in courtrooms where they'd likely face better odds.
Their court case is going to be changing venue. So it's going to leave El Paso and it's going to go to another jurisdiction like New York City or San Francisco, where, quite frankly, the courts tend to have significantly lower denial rates of asylum.
Sí, aquí está mi carnet de estudiante de la Universidad de Enfermería.
That would help Jose, who thinks he has a legitimate asylum claim since he says he was targeted by the government in Nicaragua. He stores documents in clear plastic folders, like his nursing degree and letters from community leaders describing the danger he faces.
Mi título de enfermero profesional.
Getting out of MPP and into the U.S. would be just the beginning. The Trump administration has taken more than 400 executive actions on immigration, including restricting who qualifies for asylum.
The Trump administration's approach to asylum at the southern border is assuming that no one is a legitimate asylum seeker.
Sarah Pierce is with the Migration Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank. She says with a new administration,
it's difficult to say how they would align the many interlocking policies that are at the southern border.
But she says because MPP was essentially just handed down as a memo, it could be easier to unwind than some other policies. And even if Trump is reelected, MPP is also being challenged in court. The Supreme Court recently announced it will review a case, claiming the policy violates immigration law. For now, Jose and his fiancé turn to each other for strength.
Ella me apoya mucho, pero yo aquí he servido de apoyo para ella.
She's given me a lot of emotional support, and I've tried to support her, saying, don't get down, you know, come on, let's go out, get some taquitos in the plaza to cheer up. We just give each other understanding, affection.
Darnos comprensión, cariño.
One way or another, they and thousands like them are hoping MPP comes to an end so they can start rebuilding their lives. I'm Mallory Falk in Ciudad Juarez.
And now continuing our discussions with young voters, KRWG public media intern Xavier Dominguez talked with members of the NMSU College Republicans.
A Pew Research study says 88% of Trump supporters named the economy as a top issue.
With strong economies, there's more jobs and like more opportunities. And so I'm about to graduate. I want a job.
NMSU College Republicans chair Sydney Kaiser is most focused on the economy, and she hopes to see job opportunities once she graduates.
I mean, I do think he has done pretty good for president. Like how he has decreased the unemployment rates, which is something that I was talking about with the economy. Like, I want a job. I want to be able to get like a good job when I graduate.
Earlier this year, when COVID-19 hit the United States, unemployment was at an all-time high of 14.7%. But in September, the jobless rate declined to 7.9%, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Aside from the economy, the Second Amendment is also a big issue for GOP voters. NMSU College Republicans Vice Chair Edward Kilroy is pro-gun, and he's concerned about what will happen to his rights if a Democratic administration takes office.
People running for office right now for the president and vice president positions, I don't think are very pro-freedom or pro-Second Amendment. Well, he's already made it clear that he wants to round up people's certain firearms and do all this basically unconstitutional stuff, which, in my opinion, if he tried to do that, would probably spark off a civil unrest or war.
Kaiser also says She's concerned about Second Amendment rights.
I grew up with it. Like, my family, we all own guns. It's something that my dad has taken me to the gun range countless times. Like, something that we do, and we hunt and everything. I think the main reason is protection. So you want to be able to, like, protect yourself. Like, obviously, with guns, I'm not for criminals having them. But even if we ban guns, they're criminals. They're going to find ways to get guns. But I'm mainly just like the protection aspect of guns.
The Pew Research study also finds 41% of Republican voters say immigration is a key issue. And Kilroy and Kaiser are worried about immigrants coming into the U.S. without going through the legal process.
I have no problem you coming in and or anything. My main issue personally is if someone comes in and so they're not legal or like documented or any of those official words, it's just make it legal.
I have quite a few friends that are Hispanic and even some that are Mexican citizens and then are working to become, or actually I think she is a U.S. citizen now. She's going through all the proper procedures to gain her citizenship. So I definitely think it needs to be done in accordance with the proper procedures.
With many concerns about COVID-19 and the future, both say President Trump has done a good job in handling the pandemic.
However, I think we can learn quite a bit about how people react, how societies and cultures react, and different countries react to a pandemic in this day and age. So I think it's a good learning experience. I definitely like the fact that he shut down international travel from China especially.
Like, we have so many people here and there's so many, like, towns are big and small. Like, I think it just depends on each state and how everything else regulates. So I think that him giving the power to the states was a pretty good idea.
The college Republicans we spoke with also talked about freedom of expression and abortion rights as major issues. Sydney Kaiser says she's anti-abortion, but from a different perspective.
Me being a girl, I would like to have the option to either get an abortion or to not. I would like to have that option, but just with my beliefs, like, I would most likely keep it. Because it is, like, it would be a life for me. And so, plus, I'm also more pro-adoption.
Edward Kilroy also expressed his views on abortion rights.
In terms of pro-life and abortion, that's something that we care about greatly, and the sanctity of life. And so we don't want to see that negatively impacted or affected.
Kilroy also says freedom of expression should be protected for all parties, especially young people.
I think it's really derogatory, and I do think that should probably be looked at again, especially burning of our flag. I don't think that that should be okay, but that's just my personal opinion. However, yeah, in general, freedom of expression, especially of speech, should be safeguarded and secured for our upcoming youth. They should be able to express themselves without fear of being censored out.
Aside from specific issues, Kaiser hopes to see unity and progress for the next administration with all parties.
I think that this is one of the best countries to live in, and with all of the opportunities that we have and all the freedoms. And so it's just kind of like, we can have difference of opinions and all that, but I think that having a healthy relationship with each other is something that we should strive for.
Kilroy expressed hope for progress with President Trump in the White House.
In terms of the next 4 years, I hope that President Trump wins the election, and then we can keep progressing with making the country as strong as we can and finding solutions for issues that are at hand.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Xavier Dominguez.
Thanks so much for joining us for the premiere of KRWG News this week, our full hour on Election 2020. But there is so much more to watch and hear online at KRWG.org. An unprecedented number of candidate forums produced this year at KRWG-TV. You'll find them all on the Newsmakers page in the local TV section. Also, check out the KRWG News Election Center under the News tab with a wide variety of stories on this year's fascinating election. And join us election night here on the radio starting at 4 o'clock, also on television starting at 4 with the PBS NewsHour. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.